From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. If you grow up in poverty or in a wealthy family, chances are good you'll remain at that economic level. But research from the Pew Economic Mobility Project indicates that successive generations are not necessarily locked into their parents' economic levels. We'll discuss the movement of wealth and poverty between generations. That's in the hour ahead. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. The American dream has always been about generations economically moving up and beyond the previous generation. And the Pew Economic Mobility Project conducted an intergenerational and multi-country study on economic mobility and came to a number of conclusions about upward and downward economic mobility, as well as instances of lack of movement up or down. This opening hour of Forum, we focus our attention on questions of successive generations and economic mobility and also talk about what policy, public policy, and the government is doing to either enhance or perhaps not move forward generations. Let me tell you who's joining us for the hour. Aaron Currier is project manager of the Pew Economic Mobility Project, which investigates economic health of American families, and joins us this morning from the nation's capital. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have Andrea Levere, who is president of CFED. That's a Corporation for Enterprise Development. They're a nonprofit. They work to increase economic security for low-income families and communities. And welcome, Andrea Levere.
Thank you very much. Thrilled to be here.
Glad to have you with us as well. And let's begin with you, Aaron Currier, and find out what kind of conclusions you came to in this. I guess first we ought to talk about something you call stickiness, both at the top and the bottom. More than about 60% stick to the bottom and more than half sort of stick to the top.
That's right. The Economic Mobility Project, as you mentioned, studies economic mobility, and we look at how people, how families and individuals move up and down the income ladder over their lifetimes and across generations. And it's a little bit of a complex picture because we measure mobility in two ways. The first is an absolute measure, which just looks at changes in income over time and adjusts for inflation. And when you look at that measure, we actually see a pretty positive view, a glass half full in a lot of ways, because two-thirds of adults today have higher family incomes than their parents did at the same age. And that's true across the income distribution. Typically, what we do is take the whole income distribution and divide it into equal fifths. So you could think about that as rungs on a ladder. And this ability to exceed your parents' income is actually most true at the bottom rung, that bottom fifth. 82% of families who were raised in the bottom have higher family incomes than their parents did. So that suggests a lot of upward movement and a really positive picture for the American dream.
Higher income in terms of numbers that don't figure in inflation. Or they do figure in inflation.
No, we do adjust. You do adjust for inflation. Yep. But as you mentioned, we do also see some stickiness, and that refers to a second measure of mobility, which is relative. That looks at just where someone ends up on the income distribution as a whole. And so, again, if you take equal fifths of the income distribution or five parts of the ladder, we see that people who were born or raised in that bottom fifth are highly likely to be in the bottom fifth themselves as adults. 42% remain sort of stuck in the bottom. And another 23% only make it to the second rung of the ladder. And we see the same phenomenon at the top. 39% of adults who were raised by parents in the top of the income ladder stay in the top themselves, and only 23% fall to the fourth rung of the ladder. So we call that stickiness at the ends because it suggests that even if you have higher family incomes, even if you've experienced sort of an incremental increase in income over a generation, that might not be enough to change your position on the income ladder as a whole.
Well, it also turns out from the research you've done that the biggest driver is post-secondary education, either from the bottom or attaining or staying at the top. A degree is still huge and looms as a huge factor. But one would think that, especially when one looks at the Occupy movement, that I suppose it depends on maybe what type of post-secondary education now particularly.
Post-secondary education is the most powerful driver that we've found of economic mobility. And, you know, specifically when you're, if you start in the bottom of the income distribution, having a four-year degree quadruples your chances of making it all the way to the top of the income ladder as an adult. You know, that's huge. That means that you're significantly improving your chances at economic security. And the reason that we see such a powerful influence for post-secondary education is that there's a significant wage premium when you have some college, even a two-year degree, a four-year degree. Your earning potential is significantly higher than when you have a high school diploma. That translates into greater economic security and then, therefore, greater upward mobility.
Well, I mentioned the Occupy movement because you have all these students who are deeply in debt and they have liberal arts degrees and they seem to be unable in the present recessionary climate to even find work. But you're still saying that this is a major driver and a major factor, and I understand that. Also, let's talk about the racial gap between black and white, because that's pretty significant.
It's huge. You know, our project is interested in understanding not just how Americans move on the income ladder, but what drivers are the most impactful and whether those drivers are impactful for everyone in an equal way. And one of the studies that we released looked specifically at differences between blacks and whites and their economic mobility. And what we found is that African Americans are significantly less likely than whites to move up, and they're more likely to fall down the income ladder over time. So, for instance, when we look again at that sort of stickiness at the bottom, more than half, 54% of African Americans who are raised in the bottom fifth of the income ladder stay in the bottom fifth themselves as adults, and only 31% of whites do. Probably more startling, though, is when you look at what happens to kids who are raised in the middle income quintile. So they're smack in the middle of the income distribution, definitely middle class by any measure. You know, we see that almost half, 45% of blacks who were raised in that middle section fall all the way to the bottom as adults, and only 16% of whites do.
We're talking to Erin Currier, who's with us from Washington. She's project manager of Pew's Economic Mobility Project, which investigates the economic health of American families. And we should talk about gender, too. What did you find?
Similar to the racial differences, we do see differences by gender. And specifically, we see that women are more likely to fall down the income ladder and less likely to move up the income ladder than are men. Interestingly, though, more recent research that we've put out shows that this is really a phenomenon among whites. White women have greater downward mobility than white men, whereas when you look at black women compared to black men or Hispanic women compared to Hispanic men, their rates of downward mobility are actually the same.
And you talked before about the sense of the stickiness. Some of these numbers are actually pretty alarming in that about two-thirds of those in the solid middle class really do better, but about one-third who are raised in that, call it designated solid middle class, actually fall out of it as adults. That's still a third. That's a third of the population.
It's a third. So I guess it depends on how you look at it. On the one hand, if you were to think about sort of mathematically perfect mobility, if your parents' income and their position on the income ladder didn't matter at all for where you ended up, those are the numbers we would actually expect to see. People would seem sort of almost equally likely to fall down or stay in the middle or move up. So that number, that almost a third fall out of the middle class, doesn't startle me as much as when you start dividing that by demographic group. And what we found in our research is that, again, there's huge differences in who is in that third that falls. It's much more likely to be African Americans and much more likely to be women. In fact, African American men are twice as likely as white men to fall out of the middle class.
Again, Erin Currier with us from Washington, project manager of the Pew Economic Mobility Project. And Andrea Levere is president of the Corporation for Enterprise Development. They're a nonprofit that works to increase economic security for low-income families and communities. And I guess we can say pretty plainly and baldly, Andrea Levere, that as far as the government spending goes, disproportionately high on the wealthy end and low on the poor end.
Yes, and I think there's two critical elements to build on Erin's excellent research, which is one of the major factors that contributes to the trend she describes is that we can't just look at income, but we also have to look at wealth when we're evaluating how families do and what the prospects for economic mobility are. And I'll just cite a stunning statistic that came from Pew, and I'll share the CFPB statistic, which is that in the recent report on the racial wealth gap, Pew found that the median wealth of white households is 20 times that of black households and 18 times that of Hispanic households. And it's all about how do you build the savings and the nest egg and that piece of the family balance sheet that helps you withstand the economic turbulence that we're working on today.
Well, you put a lot in your research of emphasis on savings, and yet you hear all the skepticism about, boy, you get such a low interest rate at savings. Why is savings so important here?
Well, I think savings is critical both for the financial value and also for the psychological value. And in our work, we have been building on this research for two decades to show that low-income households and low-income individuals, when they actually have the structure and the incentives to save, which is where we get to government policy, they are able to save at levels unpredicted or not predicted before, and they are able to achieve different outcomes. Just one statistic, back to our point about higher education or post-secondary education, we found that low-income children who had savings accounts for college in their own name were seven times as likely to go to college as those without. So it's about having the aspiration that you can achieve something and then having the financial resources, which in this case was $500 or more. It wasn't a huge nest egg.
So that old saw when I went to elementary school, public schools, of taking a bank book in and putting a few bucks in every week really does have value in terms of fostering, well, what's necessary toward a higher education and really toward the idea of saving psychologically, as you say.
Absolutely. And I think it also builds on the multiple strategies that are necessary to build economic security. There's just not one route. It's not simply having a good job. It's also having access to the right financial products and services that you can use. It's also having the right type of education to know how to use your savings. And it's also having incentives that work for you. One of the major studies CFPB has done is upside down the $400 billion asset building budget. We found that the federal government spends about $400 billion a year just building wealth for Americans, of which half of it goes to the wealthiest 5% of taxpayers. And we think about, what if we rethought some of those incentives and we brought it to help match the savings of low-income people to change the data point that only 8% of low-income students in America graduate from a four-year college by their mid-20s.
You also talk about the importance of social capital as something that's tremendously underestimated. Talk about that.
Well, one of the things that we all see, I think, in our personal lives is how much the combination of financial resources and social resources can change a person's life. One area where there's a huge amount of focus is mentorship in low-income schools and actually middle and higher-income schools, because it's those links and those networks that help people take advantage of opportunities. And this is why we pay so much attention to bringing low-income families and communities into the economic mainstream, where they get access to the same kind of products and services and also the expectations of what is possible.
And the neighborhood is really important, too, as we find out from the Pew study.
Yes, is that for me or for Erin?
Well, I'll come back to Erin in a moment, but I think when you talk about things like asset protection and really the sense that many people are just a paycheck away from falling into a lower bracket of what might be considered indigence, it has a great deal to do, it seems to me, with sort of what they absorb in the culture they live in, which has a lot to do with where they live.
Right. And that also has a lot to do with what are the policies where you live. It's not just what other people are doing. And in this way, I can give a shout out to the city of San Francisco, which is one of the most progressive and innovative leaders in how do we build financial security and economic opportunity, whether it's their leadership in creating the first bank-on program in the United States to help people who are un- and underbanked access financial and products and services that are reasonably priced and fair, or whether it's getting people access to direct deposit so they actually can have a banking relationship with their paycheck, or it's starting a innovative program called Kindergarten to College, where every kindergartner in the public schools starts with an account. And that is exactly the connection. If everybody in your class has something from the time you start school, then that becomes the norm. And then that behavior gets spread in neighborhoods throughout the community.
Andrea Levere, again, is president of CFED, the Corporation for Enterprise Development. Let me give out the phone number. I know there are many of you who would like to join this conversation, have questions or comments, and we're talking about intergenerational economic levels and how they go up or down. It's sort of like an escalator in many respects. The metaphor works if you think about it. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. We welcome your calls, and whether you're listening to us now on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, you can call us now. Toll-free, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments you have on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this particular segment. And you can also, of course, give us your questions or comments by going to our Facebook page. So, Aaron Currier, let me go back to you. Aaron Currier, again, is project manager at Pew's Economic Mobility Project. What about really enhancing mobility? What, from your perspective, would be best to put in a place?
Well, our project has been lucky enough to work since its inception with a pretty diverse coalition of thought leaders here in the D.C. area, and they represent pretty much a full spectrum of political thought. Some are more right-leaning, some are more left-leaning, some are more centrist. And a little while ago, they worked with us to come up with policy recommendations that they all agreed would enhance economic mobility. And I think that the really important thing about their work is that they are not necessarily in agreement about a lot of things aside from economic mobility. And when you talk about the American dream, it's clear that this is a concept that really isn't owned by the right or the left. It's a really unifying idea. And coming underneath that framework, they were able to work together to come up with 22 policy recommendations. They bucketed them into three areas. One is social capital, as you were mentioning earlier. One is financial capital, and one is human capital. And the way to think about those is human capital tends to be things like education and health, things that allow people to take advantage of opportunities to get ahead. Financial capital is exactly what Andrea was talking about, savings, assets, things that allow people to create their own safety net and to really move up the income ladder on their own and pass on wealth and inheritance to their children, help them leverage that to get ahead. And then finally, social capital we look at as the institutions and community around you. So that can be your neighborhood, it can be the people that you know who can help you get a job. And we believe that all three of those things matter. Nothing happens in a vacuum. So all of these things need to be taken into account. But I think there's clearly a lot of room for policymakers to think about things that they can do to enhance mobility in all of those areas.
And you're going to be testifying, as I understand it, on restoring middle class in Oakland. And these three categories pretty much fall along the trajectory of what you're going to contribute? In your testimony?
That's exactly right. I'm going to be speaking on Wednesday on a panel that happens from 1 to 4 p.m. at the State Office Building in Oakland. It's a committee for the on restoring California's middle class. And so I'm going to be talking a lot about the studies that we know about how people fall out of the income, how people fall out of the middle class, why they fall, and some of these specific policy levers that might help enhance mobility.
We've seen a dramatic rise, of course, in single-parent families, and it's still, when you talk about intergenerational rise, it's still axiomatic, is it not, that two earners are optimal, that, you know, a traditional nuclear family and, for that matter, a white traditional nuclear family do the best in earning?
We did release a report that looked at family structure. We were trying to understand, again, you know, to what degree does that matter for someone getting ahead? And what we found is that actually children who have divorced parents tend to do worse than children of single parents or married parents. In fact, single parenthood didn't necessarily doom someone in terms of their economic mobility prospects. But still, kids who have two-parent families, I think largely because they have two earners in their family, tend to have the best mobility outcomes. They're more likely to move up or stay where they start on the income ladder.
And Andrea Levere, according to a number of recent studies, Americans appear to be less mobile despite what's going on in Europe with the euro falling and the contagion in Greece and beyond. Recent studies show that European counterparts tend to have more mobility. I wonder if I could just ask you, frankly, from your perspective, whether the American dream, as we noted earlier, that is the ability to move beyond previous generations economically, is alive and well.
Well, one of the great things about America is that we're constantly reinventing ourselves. And I just drafted our initial strategic plan, and the topic is reinventing the American dream. And part of that is to be deeply realistic about what it takes to do so and the multiple approaches and strategies. And that's what we haven't done as effectively as we should have. And Erin framed out, I thought, a very thoughtful way to think about it. We have another tool, Michael, that we are using, which is called the Household Financial Security Framework, that takes a collective experience of the hundreds of practitioners we work with around the country and says, what are the five elements that really, really work together in an iterative way to create financial security and then mobility? And we have identified learn, which is how do you learn the basic skills to help you do this, earning, and obviously there's a major part about the stagnation in wages and benefits that go along in our labor markets. Third is save, and how do we facilitate savings and incent them? Fourth is invest. How do we identify the right type of assets to invest in? And I think that's a huge question today. We have 50 to 70 years of American policy that said the route to the middle class was home ownership. It doesn't mean that home ownership isn't still an important component, but we need to flesh it out with varying other strategies. And finally, and I think this is the legacy of the last 3 years, it's protection. How do we make sure that we protect the gains we make by addressing predatory lending and other unfair practices, and by allowing people to make choices with the full amount of information?
Well, some good regulation would help on that score, as we've discovered in programs we've done in the past. I'm going to, again, invite you to join this conversation. Really, a big question which hovers over it is the American dream alive and well, and what about economic mobility across generations? You may want to make a contribution. If you have something you'd like to contribute to the conversation, or if you have something you'd like to ask with Andrea Levere and Erin Currier, feel free to join us. It's toll-free, 866-733-6786, or send an email to forum@kqed.org, or post a question or comment on our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on this segment or go to our Facebook page. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. If you grew up in poverty or in a wealthy family, chances are pretty good that you'll remain at that economic level. In fact, we're talking about intergenerational wealth moving up or down, and the whole question of economic mobility. If, in fact, you have something to contribute, we certainly would like to hear from you. And that can include personal stories, brief and succinct, of course, though giving us an idea of how you may have moved up or down. We're getting a number of those kinds of responses by email and on our website and Facebook page. Erin Currier with us is project manager of the Pew Economic Mobility Project that investigates economic health of American families. And Andrea Levere is president of the Corporation for Enterprise Development, and they're a nonprofit that works to increase economic security for low-income families and communities. And we're asking just how alive or present the so-called American dream still is. And let's go to your calls. And Joanne, we begin with you. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thank you. I love your show. You know, I grew up in here in San Francisco in, I guess my parents, you would consider them artists, although they worked other jobs as well, and we had very little money. I think many times we would have been considered at the poverty level, but we always lived very, very well. We lived in a very desirable neighborhood. We many things. And now I myself don't make much money, would be considered at the poverty level, but I live I have no qualms, maybe I should, but I would not go into an expensive restaurant because I couldn't spend the $200. I have no qualms about going in and spending $25 on once in a while on a glass of wine and an appetizer. So I also think it's the way the woman who answered your calls, when she asked me my question, she said, your relationship with money. So I think that's also an aspect, too. I certainly would like to have a bit more money, but I think what doesn't change is not only the amount of money that you had growing up, but as I mentioned, the woman who took the call, your relationship to it, if you will.
That woman is Judy Campbell, and I think we get back here, maybe, Andrea LeVere, from this call from Joanne to the idea that, well, you were talking about savings and the psychology of savings. There's also a psychology in one's attitude toward money and how one essentially is either provident with money or improvident.
Yeah, and I think that's a really interesting point. And there's actually two points in that, which is for many, many years in this country, if you didn't have a lot of money, you could live a middle-class life, because there were good public schools you could send your children to, so you didn't have to pay for private school. And there were all sorts of other social benefits that came at a relatively low cost. So one of the questions or issues we have is that the cost of achieving the American dream is so much higher in absence of public investments that we think are important. Secondly, to kind of your comfort with money and very basic financial capability, which was the point before. If Joanne knows what her overall budget is going to be, then she can certainly splurge at a certain time because she knows it doesn't undermine her ability to live on a longer-term basis. It's kind of like dieting, that if you know you can have one ice cream a week, that makes you happy, but you don't have it every day.
And on we go to Annette joining us. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. First of all, just general congratulations to you, Michael Krasny, on a consistently high-quality program.
Thank you.
You're welcome. My question is whether either of your guests have done studies that relate to see if there is a relationship between the sustained high unemployment rates and the number of college savings accounts in low-income families. In other words, has the unemployment deterred people who still want to save for college?
Andrea LeVere, can you help us here?
So here's an interesting question, which is the primary tool that middle and upper class families use to save for college is a 529 account. And I was reminded by one of my European friends that the United States is the only country in the world that calls savings accounts or financial products by their IRS tax code number. In those, I think there's been a major issue with the loss of value in those accounts. But at the same time, they are a critical mechanism for facilitating savings over time, particularly through direct deductions out of your paycheck. One of the other issues is there's no universal savings for low-income families saving for college, and that's one of CFED's major strategies, along with many other practitioners and leaders such as the San Francisco Treasurer. And we don't yet have any kind of study because we're beginning the task of doing large scalable initiatives right now.
And again, Andrea LeVere is president of CFED, the Corporation for Enterprise Development. Aaron Currier is project manager of the Pew Economic Mobility Project. A couple questions for you, Aaron, from email. Here's Mike who says, what do you mean by the income ladder? Do you mean absolute income or do you mean relative income? Which percentile you are in? If the ladder, then for every person who moves up, someone must move down. So there is no sense in talking about how it is good for people to move up, but bad to move down.
That's a great point, and he's exactly right. When we talk about relative mobility, which is where someone might fall on the income ladder as a whole, their income rank, we are looking at an absolute top and an absolute bottom. It's the income distribution at any given time. So in order for someone to move up, someone else definitely does have to fall down. We think about this, though, in terms of equality of opportunity. If you divide the income distribution into five equal parts, that means that you should have 20% in any of those five parts. And when we see that 42% are stuck at the bottom and 39% are stuck at the top, that's a far cry from the 20% we would expect to see if you were equally likely to end up anywhere on the income distribution, regardless of where your parents started. And I think when we think about the American dream, when we think about what we strive for as a nation, we are looking for that equality of opportunity. We are looking for the ability for people to work hard and move up. And so when you don't see that 20% number, and the number is actually much higher on the ends, I think it calls into question whether we are succeeding at achieving the American dream.
Another listener, Matt, wants to know, Aaron Currier, whether or not you've corrected for families that now have a working mother. Does it take twice the work to stay in the same bracket?
We look at family income. So all the numbers that I've been talking about in terms of the percent of families that exceed their family income and where people end up on the income ladder as adults, that accounts for whether there's a single earner or a dual earner.
And we'll go to more calls. We'll welcome Drew. Good morning. You're on Forum.
Hello. I just wanted to bring up the point that it's often very difficult to maintain the gain. I made it into the top 5% bracket of wage earners and, you know, was kind of an internationally successful person in the venture community. And the poverty of childhood is often accompanied by violence. And, you know, deprivation that people just can't understand. I know a lot of people talk about post-traumatic stress for soldiers, but there's a large population of survivors of childhood poverty that are really post-traumatic stress victims. And this oftentimes comes home to roost in later years. Many people, it seems, in their 30s and early 40s, and the ability to deal with that depression, you don't have the same, because you had a weak family when you were a child, you don't have the same strong family to overcome those kinds of depression issues that you might have. Your relationship to your professional networks is not the same because you may have had difficulty socializing in some ways because of your childhood trauma and getting close to people. And so you really can't rely on those. And so it acts as this kind of anchor to pull you back.
Yeah.
And I think this is something people just don't understand.
I'm struck by your remarks, Drew, in another sense about going back to what we were talking about with Andrea LeVere earlier about the psychological effects of poverty. You know, Blake's phrase about mind-forged manacles come to mind here. And Andrea LeVere, any light you can shed on this for us?
Well, I can't agree with him more. And some of the most interesting research that is going on now across many disciplines has to do with the impact of stress on a range of factors in terms of intellectual development, human development.
Your own study, in fact, alludes to stress and economic stress.
Right, exactly. And how that both constrains your ability to make decisions and to access the resources that you need.
But this is a kind of different story we're hearing here. We're hearing about somebody who came up in poverty and then became rather successful from an economic standpoint, but still felt the pull back, if you will, to the kind of impediments or obstacles that one feels growing up in poverty.
So then I have to say, what are the supports that we put in place to provide people who have moved up? And this is also an interesting question for Erin, so that when a challenge occurs or something they didn't expect occurs, how do we help them address that? And then I go back to the power of savings and the psychological power that has to really give you a sense of stability to be able to navigate these tough and troubled waters.
You want to comment here, Aaron Currier?
I'll just jump in by saying, you know, our project has actually done two public opinion polls, one in 2009 and one just a few months ago, to better understand how Americans think about the American dream and how they define economic mobility and the things that they believe matters for economic mobility. And in our most recent poll, we found that the vast majority of Americans, 85%, would rather have financial stability then move up the income ladder as a whole. And I think, you know, the point that Andrea is making about how you have certain structures in place that not necessarily propel you forward, but just help you stay where you are, is really, really critical and really important to Americans.
Well, you know, we remember the Horatio Alger stories, the idea that anybody can get the American dream and grasp it, and it will not elude them if they are forthright, have the Puritan work ethic, work hard, believe in God and family and religion and all of those kinds of things. And I think, you know, sort of, as I said, hovering over this whole conversation is whether or not that has gone into a decline as a service economy has taken over, as a global economy has taken over, and as the economy has continued to suffer. Some thoughts from either
polling,
of you?
Well, our polling shows that that story, that idea that the United States is a special place that promotes the American dream better than anywhere else, Americans still solidly believe that. And even in the middle of a really bad time economically, we found in both of our polls a lot of optimism. 68% of Americans said that they were in control of their economic situations, and 68% said that they have already achieved or will achieve the American dream at some point in their lives. Another 61% said that they now earn enough or will earn enough to live the kind of life that they want. We see over and over and over again that Americans believe hard work and ambition are the most important things, most important drivers for someone moving ahead. So this idea that you can work hard and you can be successful is still very much a part of the American psyche.
Well, here's a listener. I'm sorry, you're going to say something here, Andrea Levere?
Yeah, but at the same time, and you raised this, Michael, with the Occupy movement, people do understand much of it because of the excellent coverage of the media, that a lot of the rules that govern who gets what are not fair and have not been adapted to the new globalized economy in which we operate. So I think it's contingent that we leverage this faith and belief and American optimism with concrete structures and incentives that address what is just an unprecedented level of both income and wealth inequality today.
I'm looking at an email from a listener named David who says, when my folks were young, they bought a house in a nice suburb for 2 times my father's average salary. My mother didn't work. Today, you can't buy the equivalent house for anything less than 10 times an average salary. Wage growth hasn't kept pace. And if the American dream includes home ownership, we do have that reality that we're facing. Here's Lee from Palo Alto. It says, NPR recently reported that Europeans now enjoy greater economic mobility than Americans. However, I know a lot of conservatives, courtesy of attending a Mormon church in Palo Alto, and my friends there believe that America has taken a huge leftward turn over the last decades, and fighting that is their first priority. Thus, they believe that the disparities and mobility limitations you're discussing are all due to nanny statism sapping people of their gumption. It's such a radical divergence from liberal thought that I despair of even a dialogue being possible. Let's go to more of your calls, and we'll welcome Frank, who's joining us from Newton, New Jersey. Hi, Frank.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Can hear you fine.
All right. I represent the 1%, believe it or not, and I'm very fortunate to be there, but I started out life with a very poor family. My father worked 3 jobs when I was growing up in the late 40s, early 50s. I was fortunate enough when I was 33 to sell my house, invest every penny I had into a business, and built it into what is now over $200 million a year business. I employ about 150 people. I have 8 children and 19 grandchildren, but the reality is they'll never have the opportunity to do what I did. All right. It just will not exist for my grandchildren or my children, or I can see it not existing for my children today. And no one talks about the reality of what's happened. You just made a mention about the young man, about the income equality, inequality from the standpoint of earning to buy a home. The reason why you can't buy a home today for the same thing his father could is because government states on the local, the state, and the federal level have put so many regulations and so many cost factors involved in processing things today that we can't afford them. If you look at what it costs to build a house today compared to what it was cost to build them in the 40s or the 50s, the demands that they put in from just insulation requirements, their safety requirements, et cetera, and we find this in business all the time. The fact of the matter is that I'm not saying the regulation isn't good in some situations, but as a businessman, as a man who does it every day and has a lot of his life invested in this, I'm 72 years of age, you just cannot accomplish today what we did 50 years ago because of the demands of society for things that they want, right, and require. Just look at cars for a matter. The demands of for all the safety items put in the car now make cars out of the reach of most people. And, you know, unless we really look at the controls that government has on costs in our lives and the roadblocks it puts in the way for people to grow businesses and build wealth, you know, it's going to be a very frustrating next 20, 25 years.
Well, Frank, I appreciate your contributing to this conversation. Good to hear from you. That's Frank from Newton, New Jersey. I don't know if Aaron Currier or Andrea Levere wants to comment, but it does get us into the realm of politics inevitably when we talk about this, doesn't it?
Well, I'll say, you know, again, referring back to the policy document that our project principals put together, one of the things that they did recommend was supports for small businesses to really help people get a foothold on the economic ladder and to be able to build their own business, to be able to be entrepreneurs. It can be a really powerful way to enhance economic mobility.
We'll go to more of your calls. We welcome Neil. Neil, you're on.
Yeah, I think what we're really talking about in terms of class mobility is not so much the middle class, which, as your people have said, is probably, you can measure it in the 60% range, the majority in this country, but the people in the lower class economically, how they can go up. We're not so concerned about middle class people going down. And I think there, well, there's several considerations, but there is a cultural component which has to be taken into consideration. The earlier generations of immigrants who came to this country, the classic upper mobility people, basically had what might be called middle-class cultural traits, and they were poor, but they had all the work and educational ethic already in them. And so when they were given the opportunity in this country, they were able to take advantage of it. And we now have a lower class, if we could want to use that term, that is less oriented towards educational upward mobility. That's one point. And I think the previous caller also made a good point. And with all our energy, I would add, with all the energy and environmental constraints that we're putting on people nowadays, and maybe for good reasons. I'm not saying they aren't good reasons, but they are taking a toll. People here in California, for example, we've made it very hard to build housing. And even if the economy was good, it's very hard to build housing here because of the environmental restraints. Well, I could go on, but let's leave it at that.
All right. I'm glad you called, Neil. Thank you. And I want to go to some of the emails here. Stephanie writes, is the American dream of everyone climbing up the income ladder unsustainable? After all, 20% of the population is always going to be in the bottom 20% of the income ladder, no matter how you slice it. The only way everyone can be going up is if you have a constant supply of immigrants coming in to fill the bottom rung of the income ladder. This seems like a Ponzi scheme to me, where every generation, new waves of immigrants fill the bottom rung. This has far-reaching implications, which should be examined in the immigration debate. What happens to income mobility if immigration stops? And somebody wrote on the web, as philosopher Alain de Botton has pointed out, in a meritocracy, people are very concerned about how much they earn and the wealth that others display. Envy is the dominant thing, but also in a meritocracy, people just assume that the poor merit their failure and that the rich merit their wealth. However, as we know, in the USA, the poor often do not merit their poverty, and the wealth often seem to cheat and swindle to gain theirs. Another listener writes, please don't underestimate the role of affirmative action in allowing for upward mobility. I grew up in a small town in South Texas with few financial resources. A Yale minority recruiter, Gilbert Garcia, came to my school and, seeing my accomplishments, encouraged me to apply to Yale. I went there and was followed by two of my brothers, who then went on to Harvard Law School. We're all now financially, socially, and emotionally successful and are providing a much better life for our children. And Dan from San Francisco says, one of your guests said incomes have risen overall, even accounting for inflation. Later, a guest said the cost of basics, education, etc., have risen dramatically. Is the standard inflation rate flawed because it doesn't account for the cost imposed by things like education? Aaron Currier?
There's a lot of debate, actually, about how we measure inflation and how you take into account the cost of things and as they change over time. Certainly, we know that things like housing, the cost of education, those have risen dramatically over the last generation. I'm not sure how we take all that into account in terms of looking at income change over generations. You probably just have to think about it as a, you know, it's a challenging measure. That's why we try to look at mobility in multiple ways, both income change over time and this relative measure of where people fall on the income distribution as a whole.
And here's Doug in Concord, who says, in 1984, I was told by a doctor that the leadership of our country was trying to turn our nation into a service economy, and he was very worried about what that would do to the future of the young. Now that his prediction has come true, I have come to a couple of my own conclusions. Economic success has more to do with who you know than anything else, and now that most of our economy is tied to making sales, another big factor is that a person will do better if they have little or no concern for their fellow man. I have an exaggerated sense of guilt and honesty, so I am basically out of luck in this new economy. Can you please tell me why a doctor could understand the failure of a service economy, but very few economists could? And another listener writes, inasmuch as government policy redistributes wealth is called welfare, can you say we have a policy of welfare for the rich? Andrea Levere?
Thank you for that. I wanted to say two things, which is, based on how we are allocating much of our wealth-building incentives, it is, as we say, upside down. So I think that's something that when we say we have no money to do things, part of our challenge going forward is based on the economic realities that we're facing, how do we reallocate them in a way that creates better return on investment? But I did want to respond to one of the comments made earlier about how it's harder to succeed today than it was before, and about the characteristics of certain people. I think all Americans are equally able to prosper and grow. And one of the things that we don't take into account is a lot of the invisible policies that made it possible in another generation to prosper. My family moved into the middle class because of the GI Bill that funded education in ways that had never been funded before at precisely the time in the 40s and the 50s that was being raised. I think that's the kind of policies that really recognize the broad-based capacity of low and moderate-income Americans to achieve that we need to focus our resources on.
And we'll focus on more of your calls and welcome Brittany as our next caller. Good morning.
Good morning. I just wanted to ask the two guests what or if they've done any research on the impact of migration in the United States has on economic mobility. My grandmother grew up in the South, sharecropping on a cotton farm. Alongside her siblings, barely finished high school, moved to New York, and then ultimately ended up in San Francisco. And here I am two generations later at one of the top graduate schools, now getting my master's degree. And I think that growing up in San Francisco definitely informed my my intellectual growth, my political views, but I always had in the background knowing that my grandmother came from this really restrictive region of the country and sacrificed by being a part of the Great Migration along with millions of other people who left the South because they knew that future generations wouldn't really have any opportunity to do much better. So I'm just curious on research about migration and the impact on mobility.
Well, there's a wonderful book about the Black migration, but I don't know if any of you or either of you have found anything in your research that correlates to that. Andrea Levere or Aaron Currier?
Well, I can respond not to the specific issue of migration, but in terms of looking at different contexts for how you can move ahead, which is CFED produces every 2 years the Assets and Opportunity Scorecard, which is on our website, which looks at how each state...
Andrea, excuse me, why don't you give out your website, because people probably would like to look at that.
Thank you very much. www.cfed.org, and it looks
both in terms of outcome measures and policies of how every state helps to build and protect the assets of its residents. And it gives you a comparison between the states on a range of measures that help to build economic security and mobility.
Let me try to get another quick call in here. Holly, that's you. Welcome. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you very much. I just wanted to respond to somebody who spoke several calls ago, a small business person who said it was difficult for him and his children and grandchildren to get ahead because of regulation. And I'd like to make the comment that slavery made labor an awful lot cheaper. But obviously we've regulated that out of our system, and that there is in fact some regulation that is necessary. And blaming things like building insulation and auto safety, I think, is misplacing blame on regulation.
Okay. I thank you for that comment, and that will stand as the last and final comment here today because we've come to the end of this hour. I want to extend thanks to Andrea Levere and Aaron Currier for being with us this hour. Aaron Currier, again, is project manager of the Pew Economic Mobility Project. They investigate economic health of American families. And you want to give your website, Aaron?
Sure. It's economicmobility.org.
And people can go to your website and read the whole report.
Yes, all of our reports are online, as well as a really nice 3-minute video that explains absolute and relative mobility.
And again, Andrea Levere is president of the Corporation for Enterprise Development, a nonprofit working to increase economic security for low-income families and communities. You can continue this discussion by going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or you can go to our Facebook page, and we certainly welcome your ongoing contributions on that score. We have another hour ahead. James C. Hormel will be joining us in the hour ahead, the first openly U.S. gay ambassador. And we'll talk about his book, and we'll talk about really a number of things having to do with the work that he's done politically and as a philanthropist. His new book is Fit to Serve, Reflections on a Secret Life, Private Struggle, and Public Battle to Become the First Openly Gay U.S. Ambassador. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Thanks to Senior Editor Dan Zold, to our producers, Kevin Guillory, Judy Campbell, and Tina Larberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.